Good morning and welcome. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Paul Weick, with today's Wall Street Journal. And in today's Wall Street Journal, some of the articles we will be reading: home sales in December jump 5.1%, the biggest gain in nearly 2 years. Also, Trump says Iran has stopped killing protesters. Saks Global files for bankruptcy, undone by debt and a luxury slump. We'll see what's being heard on the street. And we'll also go to the opinion section and some of the business news, some of the other business news. So let's go ahead and get started right away with that home sales article. Home sales in December jumped 5.1%, the biggest gain in nearly 2 years. Easing mortgage rates and slower growth in home prices boosted sales to the highest level since February of 2023. It is reported by Nicole Friedman. Here's the article. Home sales finished 2025 with surprisingly strong momentum, rising 5.1% in December for the biggest gain in nearly 2 years. But even with last month's boost, the year as a whole still ranks as one of the worst sales slumps in decades. The increase in sales, which was more than double what economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal had expected, reflected easing mortgage rates and slower growth in home prices. On a monthly basis, the existing home sales gain was the biggest since February of 2024 and the fourth straight monthly increase, the National Association of Realtors said on Wednesday. The four consecutive months of rising sales is the longest streak since 2020. The December sales rate was the highest since February of 2023. The higher sales were essentially driven, in my view, by lower interest rate conditions, said Lawrence Yun, NAR's chief economist. There is pent-up demand, he continued. When does it get released? When the mortgage rates begin to move. End of his quote. The average 30-year fixed mortgage rate has hovered around 6.2% in recent weeks, down from the start of the year when rates were closer to 7%. Home price growth is also slowing. The national median existing home price in December was $405,400, a 0.4% increase from December of 2024, the NAR said. If mortgage rates continue to fall, that could draw more buyers to the housing market this year after a long stretch of depressed sales. President Trump said last week that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would buy $200 billion in mortgage bonds in an effort to bring down rates and stimulate home buying. Despite the rise in activity in December, 2025 marked the third straight year of dismal sales, falling to a level that by one measure represented the worst slump for the housing market in more than four decades. Existing home sales of 4.06 million last year held at their lowest level since 1995, NAR said. But the U.S. population is now more than 70 million larger than it was 30 years ago. And last year's sales pace looks worse when measured as a share of total households. There were about three sales for every 100 U.S. households last year. That marks the lowest ratio since 1982, according to an analysis by First American Financial, which is a title insurance and real estate services company. In 1982, the U.S. economy was mired in recession, and mortgage rates were around 16%. Now, 3 years of high home prices have caused millions of Americans to postpone or give up on the dream of home ownership. Home prices are up more than 50% since 2019. Mortgage rates are still more than double where they were in 2021, when more than 6 million homes sold around the peak of the housing boom. The historically low level of home sales is frustrating renters who want to own and homeowners who want to relocate, upsize, or downsize, but don't think the move makes financial sense. Millions of homeowners have low mortgage rates that they are unwilling to give up. And uncertainty about the job market is also making prospective buyers nervous about making a big purchase. Buyers are being really choosy, said Megan Miko, a real estate agent in Berkeley, California. Buyers are saying, if I lose my job, we need to be able to cover this on one salary, end of her quote. The unaffordable housing market has become a focal point for politicians, and broad concerns about the cost of living helped Democrats in recent elections. President Trump, who last week said he wants to ban large investors from buying single-family homes, added he would propose more housing policies later this month. But the biggest problem in the housing market, a shortage of supply that renters and buyers can afford, can take years to fix. Economists say the most likely resolution of the current home buying affordability crisis is a slow and steady improvement as buyers' incomes rise, home price growth remains slow, and mortgage rates fall slightly from current levels. It's a struggle for a lot of potential first-time home buyers, said Odette Akushi, deputy chief economist at First American. What people are feeling are the cumulative effects of years of inflation, end of her quote. Economists are predicting an increase in home sales this year as affordability improves and some buyers and sellers decide they can't keep waiting. The inventory of homes for sale has been rising, giving buyers more options. Gilad and Dasi Matiyahu rented a home when they moved to Dallas in 2022 because they thought the housing market was too competitive and overpriced. By late last year, the market had slowed. The Matiyahus found a house they wanted, toured it a couple of times, and put in an offer. They bought the house in December for about 4% below the listing price, and the seller covered some of their closing costs. "I think we got lucky with how things played out in the market," Gilad Matiyahu said. "We were waiting for this to happen for a long time." Still, a huge jump in activity next year is unlikely, Cushy said, because many Americans still won't be able to afford to buy and the outlook for the job market is uncertain. Homebuyers are also facing higher costs in many cases for home insurance, property taxes, and homeowner association dues. Home buying affordability has improved somewhat in recent months as mortgage rates have slid to around 6.2% and home price growth has held at low levels. The typical monthly payment for a buyer purchasing a median-priced home with a 20% down payment was $2,365 in the 4 weeks ended January 4th, the lowest level since early 2024, according to the real estate brokerage Redfin. Last year, quote, "We hit a peak on affordability and the market came to a halt," said Lauren Dempsey, a real estate agent in the Denver area. "But some buyers who took a pause then are returning now," she said. "The market's definitely started to pick up," end of her quote. News Corp, owner of the journal, operates Realtor.com under license from the NAR. And that was the lead article. Home sales in December jumped 5.1%, the biggest gain in nearly 2 years, and that was reported by Nicole Friedman. Our next article is an international one. Trump says Iran has stopped killing protesters. And this is reported by Lara Seligman, Benoit Fasson, and Ken Thomas. Here's the article. President Trump on Wednesday said Iran had stopped killing anti-regime protesters and would not execute those it accused of trying to topple the government, appearing to narrow the possibility that the U.S. was about to launch military strikes against the country. Speaking at the White House, Trump told reporters that the U.S. had been notified Iran had, quote, no plans to carry out any executions of protesters, end quote. "We've been told that killing in Iran is stopping. It has stopped," Trump said. "That has just gotten to me, some information that the killing has stopped, that the executions have stopped. They are not going to have an execution," which a lot of people were talking about for the last couple of days. "Today was going to be the day of execution," end of his quote. He said that he hoped what officials had been told was true. Trump has been considering military strikes on Iranian targets in recent days amid reports that thousands of protesters have been killed and others who have been arrested could soon be put to death, the Wall Street Journal previously reported, but has received briefings on a range of options. Asked if military action was off the table, Trump said, "We're going to watch it and see what the process is, but we were given a very good statement by people that are aware of what's going on," end of a quote. Earlier Wednesday, the U.S. military said it was evacuating some personnel from Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar as a precaution. The personnel are moving out of the base where the U.S. military has a major presence, given the escalating tensions between Washington and Tehran, a U.S. official and another person familiar with the matter said. Later in the day, Iran closed its airspace to flights, except those given permission by the authorities in Tehran. Trump on Tuesday told Iranians demonstrating against their government that, quote, help is on its way, end quote. He also told reporters Tuesday that Americans in Iran should consider evacuating the country. The president ordered a strike on Iranian nuclear sites during a 12-day war in June. Iran retaliated by firing missiles at Al Udeid base, but they did little damage, with most intercepted by air defenses. Iran warned Sunday it could strike U.S. bases in the Middle East, shipping lanes, or Israel in the event of a U.S. attack. Trump's stepped-up warnings to Iran come as the death toll grows in protests that are now in their third week. The group Human Rights Activists in Iran said Wednesday the toll had surpassed 2,400 as the regime has moved to crush demonstrations. It said more than 140 members of the government security forces had been killed and that more than 18,000 people had been detained. Other rights groups have put the toll even higher, though a six-day continuing internet blackout and phone service disruptions have made it difficult to verify them. Iran signaled Wednesday it was preparing to conduct swift trials and the execution of anti-government protesters, further defying Trump. The family of Irfan Soltani, a 26-year-old man who was arrested on January 8th, had been told his death sentence would be carried out on Wednesday, according to Ayer Shehi of Henga Organization for Human Rights, which is a Norway-based nonprofit. But a relative of Soltani's said later that her family had heard that the sentence would not be carried out that day after all. In a statement, Henga said the execution order had been postponed. Aboard Air Force One on Tuesday, Trump told reporters he was expecting a report on the latest situation in Iran and dismissed a threat by the country's leaders to retaliate to any U.S. attack. Trump for days has received briefings from top members of his team, including Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who have presented him with a suite of options. Many of the options don't involve force of arms, including cyber attacks, sanctions, or supporting anti-regime messaging online, officials said. Trump for now has ruled out negotiations with Iran, he said Tuesday on Truth Social. Quote, I've canceled all meetings with Iranian officials until the senseless killing of protesters stops, end quote. If he does decide to authorize an attack, his options to do so are limited by the shift of military personnel and equipment to the Caribbean. Only six U.S. Navy warships are now in the Middle East, three littoral combat ships and three destroyers, versus 12 in the Caribbean, according to a Navy official. There is no aircraft carrier strike group nearby either, because Trump ordered the Gerald Ford carrier group from the Mediterranean to the Caribbean in October. The Pentagon could still order Tomahawk missile strikes from destroyers in the Middle East, as well as send bombers and jet fighters stationed in the region equipped with long-range weapons. In contrast, during the June war launched by Israel, the U.S. was flush with military assets in the region. While Iran proved helpless against Israeli and U.S. airstrikes, it did launch barrages of ballistic missiles that got through Israeli defenses and depleted inventories of interceptors. Protecting American troops stationed in the region becomes more precarious without an aircraft carrier and its accompanying destroyers, which are equipped with the Aegis combat system that provides the ability to shoot down incoming missiles. But officials and experts say the U.S. still can defend its forces in the area by other means, including using Patriot batteries and air defense systems from regional partners across the Middle East. And that was Trump Says Iran Has Stopped Killing Protesters. It was on page A1, reported by Laura Seligman, Benoit Fasson, and Ken Thomas. Next, let's turn to a business article that was on, I believe it was on the front page as well. Saks Global files for bankruptcy, undone by debt and a luxury slump. The retailer becomes the highest profile department store chain to file for Chapter 11 since the pandemic. It's reported by Suzanne Kapner and Becky Urach. The parent of Saks Fifth Avenue Ann Neiman Marcus filed for bankruptcy protection barely a year after an ambitious bet on luxury department stores brought the two storied retailers together in what was supposed to be a powerhouse deal. The swift unraveling of Saks Global shows the perils of doubling down on department stores whose golden days are long past. The plan behind the $2.7 billion merger was to create a luxury juggernaut. While cost savings from the deal were expected to help Saks dig out of a deepening hole of delayed payments to suppliers. But with a roughly $100 million debt payment that was due in December and sales declining, the company ran out of time. It is now the highest profile department store chain to file for Chapter 11 since the pandemic. Jeffrey Van Ramdonk, the former chief executive of Neiman Marcus, has been picked to lead Saks through bankruptcy as its CEO, effective immediately. In all, Saks has secured roughly $1.75 billion in financing for the process, the company said early Wednesday. Things went wrong for Saks even before its merger with Neiman Marcus. A widespread slowdown in luxury goods that began in 2023 hurt sales. Saks struggled to pay vendors, some of which curtailed shipments or stopped shipping goods. That made it harder for Saks to bring in revenue. Saks further angered suppliers last February when it extended payment terms to 90 days from the typical 60. Back payments would be spread among 12 monthly installments beginning in July, rather than made in a lump sum, according to a memo sent to suppliers on Valentine's Day. Oh, that's sweet. The company raised an additional $600 million in June through a debt restructuring, but sales continued to fall, dropping 13% from a year earlier to $1.6 billion for the period ended August 2nd. The net loss widened to $288 million. Days after missing that $100 million debt payment, longtime CEO Mark Metrick resigned. Executive Chairman Richard Baker briefly took over before stepping down as well on Tuesday. A bondholder group, including Pentwater Capital and Bracebridge Capital, has now agreed to provide $1 billion of debtor-in-possession financing to carry Saks through the bankruptcy, Saks said early Wednesday. Asset-based lenders, led by Bank of America, will release about $250 million in credit. In addition, the bondholder group agreed to fund an additional $500 million of equity financing upon emergence from bankruptcy. The company's implosion has left the fashion industry reeling, with suppliers wondering if they will be made whole, and shoppers lamenting the weakened state of yet more iconic retailers following the bankruptcies in recent years of Barneys New York, Lord & Taylor, and Hudson's Bay in Canada. The latter two had been owned by Baker. Assuming Saks Global is able to reorganize and emerge from bankruptcy, it will likely be a smaller entity with fewer stores. There are roughly 33 Saks stores and 36 Neiman Marcus locations, a handful of which are in the same mall or city. The company also includes two Bergdorf Goodman stores and about 80 Saks Off Fifth discount stores. As part of the bankruptcy, Saks said, it is evaluating its operational footprint to invest resources where it has the greatest long-term potential. That's a quote, obviously. Department stores used to have clout over their suppliers, but in recent years, some suppliers, such as Louis Vuitton parent LVMH and Gucci parent Kering, have towered over the retailers they sell to. More importantly, brands of all sizes have opened their own boutiques, competing directly with their department store customers. Although Saks is inextricably linked to New York through its flagship store across the street from the Rockefeller Center, it got its start in Washington, D.C. in 1867, when Andrew and Isidore Saks opened a men's clothing store. In 1902, the brothers opened a large store in New York City's Herald Square near Macy's that sold men's and women's fashions. When Andrew died in 1912, his son, Horace Saks, took over. Two decades later, Saks and Company merged with another department store company, Gimbel Brothers, which was owned by Horace's cousin, Bernard Gimbel. Sachs continued to operate as an autonomous subsidiary, and in 1924 opened its now-famed location at 611 Fifth Avenue across the street from what would become Rockefeller Center. The move was controversial. Sachs was among the first large retailers to locate in what was then primarily a residential area, not far from the Vanderbilt and Astor mansions. The building, with its limestone facade, took up an entire city block. In the ensuing years, Sachs opened stores throughout the country and cycled from one owner to another. In 1973, it was bought by cigarette maker British American Tobacco. Next came Investcorp, the Bahrain investment firm, which acquired the retailer in 1990. Sachs went public in 1996 and 2 years later merged with middle market department store company Profits, which changed its name to Sachs. In 2013, it was bought by HBC, a holding company of which Baker was executive chairman. At the time, it included Lord & Taylor and the Hudson's Bay department store chain in Canada. When HBC bought Sachs, department stores had been failing for decades. Gimbel's went out of business in the 1980s. Lord & Taylor filed for bankruptcy in 2020 and closed all its stores, though it continues to operate online. Neiman Marcus filed for bankruptcy in 2020, but emerged later that year, and Hudson's Bay closed all its stores in 2025 after filing for bankruptcy protection. I was thinking this sounds like an obituary for a bit, but okay, back to the article. Part of the appeal of Sachs was its real estate. Less than a year after HBC agreed to buy Sachs, the chain's Fifth Avenue location was valued at $3.7 billion, more than the $2.9 billion price of the whole deal. Unlike some investors who buy retailers and strip them for the real estate, HBC poured money into Sachs, completing a $300 million renovation of the Fifth Avenue store around 2019 that included a Rem Koolhaas-designed escalator. As part of the reboot, it moved cosmetics and fragrances from the ground floor, where they had resided since the store opened, to the second floor. Handbags and leather goods took over the store's most valuable ground floor real estate. The move was considered a gamble at the time by some industry executives because cosmetics and fragrances had long been a good source of impulse purchases and a way to pull shoppers into the store. In 2021, Sachs undertook another controversial move. It split its stores and e-commerce business into separate companies. The move was designed to pave the way for the digital business to sell shares to the public, but once the shares of other digital pure plays, such as Farfetch, collapsed, a listing was no longer viable. Department stores are known for their lavish holiday window displays, but in 2023, Sachs upped the ante when it partnered with French luxury brand Dior. The facade of the 10-story building was transformed into a carousel that turned into a light show every evening. Each of the windows displayed scenes of New York and Paris. Sachs canceled its holiday light show in 2024, but reinstated it in 2025. In recent months, Sachs Global tried to cut deals to raise cash. In December, it sold the land beneath the Neiman Marcus store in Beverly Hills in San Francisco for about $100 million, according to a person familiar with the deals. And it had been trying to sell 49% of Bergdorf Goodman for about $1 billion, according to people familiar with the situation. With the debt payment looming, time ran out. And that was an article by Suzanne Kapner and Becky Urach. The headline was Sachs Global Files for Bankruptcy, Undone by Debt and a Luxury Slump. And I'll just remind everybody that Chapter 11 bankruptcy is a reorganization. It doesn't mean that it is the end of Sachs, Neiman Marcus. It's not liquidating, which is a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Well, let's take a moment. We're almost at the midpoint. Let's say we're listening to the Wall Street Journal program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Paul Weick. And if you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org. Then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Now, back to the next article. Let me flip screens there and tabs. Our next article is an interesting one, given a lot of the news we've been hearing about in the business section. America's biggest power grid operator has an AI problem: too many data centers. And increasing, the subheadline is, increasing demand from tech industry threatens to max out generation capacity in 13-state region. Rate increases anger consumers. This is reported by Catherine Blunt and Jennifer Hiller. America's AI boom is pushing the nation's largest power grid operator to the brink of a supply crisis. 67 million people in a 13-state region stretching from New Jersey to Kentucky get their power from a market operated by nonprofit PJM. So too do the many AI data centers springing up in Northern Virginia's Data Center Alley, which have a bottomless appetite for electricity. Rates are going up for consumers, older power plants are going out of service faster than new ones can be built, and the grid's capacity is in danger of maxing out during periods of high demand, which could force PJM to call for rolling blackouts during heat waves or deep freezes to avoid damaging grid infrastructure. Mark Christie, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, said that a few years ago he considered the PJM blackout threat to be on the horizon. "Now I'm saying that the reliability risk is across the street," he said. PJM expects power demand to grow by 4.8% a year on average for the next decade, an astonishing pace for a system that has not had substantial demand growth in years. Consumers are furious about the rate increases, and tech companies, including Amazon, Alphabet, and Microsoft, have fought against proposed rules that would require data centers to build their own power sources or go dark during demand surges. Potential solutions to PJM's problems are complex, controversial, and nearly impossible to implement quickly. Adding to the challenge, the organization's longtime chief executive, Manu Asthana, stepped down at the end of 2025 with no successor yet in place. PJM board chairman David Mills will serve as interim CEO until a replacement is chosen. The reliability challenges facing the grid are real, but they are not unsolvable, Mills said in a written statement. PJM is coordinating with policymakers, regulators, and industry, he said, to align investments in power generation and transmission with increasing demand. Grid operators such as PJM, originally called the Pennsylvania-New Jersey-Maryland Interconnection, play a vital role in the U.S. energy system. In the vast region served by PJM, it serves as the intermediary between power producers and the utilities that own the poles and wires and deliver the electricity to consumers. PJM's mission is to balance supply and demand by telling power plants when to ramp production up or down. Other regions of the country are also seeing a surge in power demand tied to data centers. West Texas and the parts of the Southeast and the Southwest are becoming home to massive facilities. Power demand forecasts vary widely, but analysts expect significant growth in the coming years. An analysis by consulting firm ICF forecasts U.S. power demand in 2030 will be 25% higher than it was in 2023, largely because of data center needs. In a PJM control room about 20 miles northwest of Philadelphia, rotating teams of operators keep watch for threats to the grid's stability. The command hub is kept movie theater dark so the operators, known as dispatchers, can better study the wall-to-wall screens showing the movement of electricity across the service area. The region's network of high-voltage power lines is lighted up on a large digital map, while a series of graphs and tables show which plants are producing power and how much it costs. PJM's energy dispatchers essentially function as air traffic controllers, rerouting power as needed. Any imbalance between supply and demand can alter the frequency of the grid, potentially damaging power plants and other equipment. As data centers have multiplied, it has gotten more challenging for PJM to handle surges in demand. Northern Virginia is home to more data centers for companies such as Amazon than any other part of the country. Google said last year it planned to invest $25 billion over the next 2 years to build out data centers in the same service area. Dominion Energy, the utility company serving parts of Virginia, has received requests from data center developers that would require more than 40 gigawatts of electricity, enough to power at least 10 million homes. Those requests alone amount to roughly twice the capacity than Dominion had across its Virginia network at the end of 2024. By 2039, Dominion expects peak demand on its system to double. When Astana took over as CEO of PJM in 2020, power plants within its service area were shutting down more quickly than they could be replaced. 6 years later, that trend has continued, even though power demand has risen. State environmental policies have accounted for some of the closures. Illinois, Michigan, Maryland, and other states on the PJM grid have shut down some coal and gas-fired units to reduce carbon emissions. Other shutdowns have come for economic reasons. Coal-fired and nuclear plants had a hard time competing after the shale boom unleashed abundant, inexpensive natural gas supplies and the cost of wind and solar projects plummeted. PJM's troubles have become so pronounced that Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, a Democrat, filed a complaint with federal regulators in 2024, seeking, among other things, to cap price increases in the PJM market. In September, the governor convened a meeting between governors and representatives from all 13 states within PJM, where he called for more political oversight on prices. For the largest grid in the nation to have the fewest avenues for customers and their elected representatives to be heard is unacceptable, Shapiro said. At the time, then-CEO Astana suggested that elected officials have made the problem worse by making it harder to build and operate power plants. "We can do whatever we want in the markets," he said, "but if our plants run into a hostile siting and permitting regime, they will not get built." In New Jersey, rates for residents spiked by about 20% in June. Governor-elect Mikey Sherrill made electricity prices a signature issue in her campaign, vowing in her victory speech to, quote, "declare a state of emergency on day one," close quote, to drive down utility costs. The governors of Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Maryland have threatened to walk away from PJM, though it would be difficult for most states to pull out because their utilities generally don't own power plants. Federal authorities would need to approve any state withdrawals. Unlike the single-state power markets in California, New York, and Texas, PJM's market encompasses multiple states run by officials with disparate political views. "One of the fundamental problems that PJM faces is political," said Christie, the former FERC chairman. "You've got 13 different states with 13 very different policies about what kind of generation they want and about who can build generation," end of his quote. This past summer, a series of heat waves drove power demand on the PJM grid to near record highs. In June, with consumers cranking their air conditioners, PJM called on every power plant to run at full steam. It also began reducing demand by paying some large energy users, such as factories, to power down, a tactic known as demand response. Its aim was to avoid rolling blackouts that would have affected many more customers. Rolling blackouts, used only rarely in the U.S., can be dangerous. In Texas, more than 200 people died after the grid operator there issued emergency orders for utilities to cut power during a severe freeze in February 2021. Because an unprecedented number of power plants tripped offline in the cold, utilities were forced to make huge cuts, and some people were in the dark for 4 days. PJM's grid reliability challenges during weather extremes are intensifying as data centers, which generally aim to operate around the clock, suck up more power. In September, PJM released proposals meant to balance data center needs with those of other customers, including one that would cut power to data centers during times of extreme strain on the grid. That one included possible exceptions for data centers that either arrange for their own power supplies or volunteer to participate in demand response. Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and others said parts of that proposal discriminated against data centers. They opposed almost every facet of it, expressing concern about the prospect of being cut off from the grid, the cost of building power plants, and the feasibility of powering down. Tech companies put forward counterproposals that would make building power plants or going offline strictly voluntary for data centers within PJM. In November, efforts to establish new rules for data centers stalled when PJM executives, tech companies, power suppliers, utilities, and the independent monitor that oversees the market could not agree on a plan. PJM's Board of Managers is now working to propose one. The market monitor, Joseph Bowring, has urged federal regulators to intervene. In a complaint filed with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, the monitor said PJM should stop admitting new data centers to the grid unless there are enough power plants and transmission lines to serve them. Bowring's firm, Monitoring Analytics, has been sounding the same warning for months. Unless data centers bring their own power supply, the firm said in a letter to the grid operator in November, quote, PJM will be in the position of allocating blackouts rather than ensuring reliability. End of the quote and end of the article. And there's a correction and amplification at the end of the article. In New Jersey, rates for residents spiked by about 20% in June. An earlier version of the article incorrectly said they spiked only about 2%. Instead of 20%. But that was corrected in the article that we just read. And that article was headlined, America's Biggest Power Grid Operator Has an AI Problem, Too Many Data Centers. And it was reported by Catherine Blunt and Jennifer Hiller. Well, I think it's time to do the herd on the street. Let's see if we can find that. Here it is. It's written by Telos Demos, and the headline is, it's not time to dump megabank shares just yet. Investors have sold big bank stocks in the wake of earnings, but the outlook is still bright. Here's that herd in the street column. Don't cash in your chips in big banks yet. The U.S. megabanks appear to be having a buy the rumor, sell the news moment. Investors gobbled up shares of these global lenders last year. Now, with banks confirming via fourth quarter reports that 2025 was indeed a strong year, their shares are tumbling. The four megabanks reporting as of Wednesday are down almost 7% on average this week. Certainly, some sticking points for lenders have emerged from Washington early this year. Will President Trump find a way to make good on a pledge to cap credit card rates? Could the Federal Reserve cut rates even more aggressively than believed this year, further denting banks' hope for growth in interest income? Could growing geopolitical uncertainty quash a rebound in deal-making? Even without a crystal ball to answer all those questions, investors may view all those swirling questions as reason enough to take some profits after a year of big gains. All six of the U.S. megabanks, which are Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo, beat the S&P 500 last year. This move left those banks trading at high valuations. The average price-to-book ratio of the four giant lenders, Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Wells, approached 1.8 times earlier this month, according to FactSet data. That is a level not seen in almost 20 years. Certainly, there is risk to banks in an unpredictable political environment, but investors also should consider what seems to be the Trump administration's broader agenda: supercharge the economy and investment activity, or what is sometimes termed run it hot. On the whole, that ought to keep banks firing on most, if not all, cylinders in 2026. Banks are printing some solid numbers in loan growth, with a lot of that coming from loans to non-bank financial institutions. Likewise, banks are still seeing their trading activity expand, in part through growing financing of their clients. That would be boosted by lower rates, deregulation, and other policy measures. These are meant to encourage many of the kinds of underlying activity that is ultimately driving a lot of this financing. such as investments in data centers, and energy infrastructure. There is also what is happening with bank regulation. A lighter approach to capital requirements would allow banks to continue to allocate more of their resources toward these loans and financing. And because these arrangements are often backed by collateral, they don't add as much to banks' risk weightings as traditional unsecured business loans. Not enough quote-unquote cockroach losses in the form of frauds or surprising losses have emerged so far to derail that growth yet. Plus, if the bond market reacts as some fear it would to an aggressive Fed or additional fiscal stimulus, driving higher long-term bond yields, that could help banks offset the impact to interest income of lower short-term rates. Lower short-term funding rates can reduce banks' deposit costs, while higher bond yields could allow banks to continue to redeploy cash from maturing older bonds into higher-yielding new ones. The shape of the yield curve, or the difference between the short and long-term rates, can matter as much as the level of rates. Whether a credit card rate cap could possibly come into effect is naturally a huge unknown risk. What is known, however, is the fiscal stimulus to consumers and businesses that can come from the 2026 budget mix. Larger tax refunds can pad deposit balances and boost spending. While many lower-income consumers may struggle with benefits cuts, those aren't the bulk of banks' borrowing customers, especially not in profitable businesses like wealth management. Higher asset prices could still support more lending growth to the top of the K-shaped economy. Meanwhile, banks' higher valuations aren't stretched relative to the rest of the market. Since 2010, those four big lenders have on average traded at a forward price-earnings multiple that is around 65% that of the S&P 500's ratio. Today, they're trading at closer to 55%. It is a similar trend with price-to-book ratios, though that is often a less relevant measure for non-bank companies. To be sure, banks remain vulnerable to a big economic or market correction. Any such pullback could lead to higher credit losses, and any deleveraging by trading and non-bank customers would curtail loan growth. An accompanying defensive move into government bonds could also lower longer-term yields. The asset values now aiding wealthy customers and growing management fees would turn into a drag. That said, plenty of investors and economists have been predicting a recession or market downturn for 3 years now, only for markets and the economy to power ahead. Will some affordability measures narrowly target banks? Perhaps. Yet, if dramatic policy moves were to actually materialize and a rate cap did not materialize, banks would also stand to benefit from things like a big boost to home sales or improved consumer budgets. As long as investors continue to believe the economy writ large is going to be running hot, big bank stocks are likely to keep chugging ahead. And that was a column by Telos Demos, and he says it's not time to dump mega bank shares just yet. That was the Herd on the Street column in today's Wall Street Journal. Should we go to the opinion section? Let's go to the opinion section, see where the Wall Street Journal's editorial board stands. And their question for you is, where's Congress on Russia sanctions? Trump has given the green light for a tariff bill on countries that buy Russian oil. And this is by the WSJ editorial board. Here it is. Americans are swiveling their heads between Iran and Venezuela and wondering what the turmoil in these countries means for the U.S. Allow us to connect the dots among Iran, Venezuela, Russia, and China, and explain why Congress can help the world by passing a languishing sanctions bill on Moscow's oil. President Trump last week greenlit a Russia sanctions bill with more than 80 Senate co-sponsors, according to GOP Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Mr. Graham's bill would allow Mr. Trump to impose tariffs of up to 500% on countries that purchase Russian oil. The main purchasers of Russian oil are India and China, though New Delhi has been hunting for other sources. Mr. Trump would have flexibility in his implementation of the tariff sanction, but having the tool in his pocket could help in negotiations. Tariffs aren't without economic risk, but there are other sources of oil in the world for these buyers. Vladimir Putin still refuses to make any concessions for peace or even for a temporary ceasefire. The Russian dictator is firing ballistic missiles at cities and thundering about variants that carry nuclear weapons. Mr. Putin has also rejected the possibility of Western forces in Ukraine after the war ends. America's allies in the UK and France are answering the call for troops in Ukraine to help sustain a peace after a deal is struck, but the main problem is the man in the Kremlin. Mr. Trump deserves credit for his current campaign of boarding shadow oil tankers and not being deterred by the pretense of a Russian flag on a ship. The Journal reports that more than 15 tankers have suddenly announced their affiliation with Mother Russia in the past 2 weeks alone as a way to dodge U.S. sanctions enforcement. By seizing the ships anyway, the Trump administration is exerting pressure on Moscow, Iran, and Venezuela. This will increase U.S. leverage in Ukraine talks, though perhaps still not enough after a year of U.S. negotiating policy that has amounted to toxic empathy toward Mr. Putin and his grievances. Russia's economy is under increasing strain, and the sanctions bill is a chance to raise the costs of refusing to make peace. Yet, despite Mr. Trump's apparent approval and strong bipartisan support, the sanctions bill remains in limbo. Congress is preoccupied trying to pass government funding bills before a deadline at the end of the month. Given current congressional dysfunction, even showing that America can pass appropriations would be an achievement. But Congress can't sleep on a window of opportunity to improve the U.S. position vis-a-vis Mr. Putin and his friends in Beijing and Tehran. What's happening in the world is not a series of coincidental unrelated events. Under Joe Biden, an axis of U.S. adversaries arose that is working together against the West: China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, Cuba, and Venezuela. Iran has fed Russia drones for its war in Ukraine, and Russia returns the favor with military training jets and cash. North Korea provides artillery shells and troops, while Russia protects Pyongyang's nuclear program. China buys oil from Russia while supplying vital parts for the Kremlin's military. In Venezuela and Iran, Mr. Trump is targeting the weak links of this coalition of hostility. The Russia sanctions bill is an attempt to raise the costs of their cooperation by cutting off a major source of finance for Russia's war of conquest. Congress can help the commander-in-chief play every card in this larger strategic contest by giving him the ability to impose sanctions on Russian oil producers. And that was the Wall Street Journal's editorial board. Where is Congress on Russia sanctions? And obviously from the opinion section. Okay, our next article, maybe our last article, let's see. It's not too long. The futile campaign to get people to dress better on planes. And this is in the lifestyle travel section of the Wall Street Journal, reported by Dean Seal. Here's the article. Could dressing nicer get air travelers to behave better? The U.S. government thinks so. Passengers might be a tougher sell. The Transportation Department kicked off the 2025 holiday travel season with an admittedly unenforceable civility campaign aimed at bringing back, quote-unquote, courtesy and class to air travel, close quote. Since 2019, in-flight outbursts have climbed fivefold, with a particular surge around the pandemic, according to the Federal Aviation Administration. If more flyers opt for jeans and a decent shirt, cooler heads may prevail, according to Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. Let's try not to wear slippers and pajamas as we come to the airport, he said at Newark Liberty International Airport in late November. If you've spent any time at cruising altitude, you would be forgiven for thinking Duffy may have picked a fight he can't win. Comfort may be hard to find on fashion runways, but it is firmly embedded on actual runways, even spawning travel-specific lines like Spanx's Air Essentials. Some influencers on TikTok vowed to make pajamas and slippers their official airport dress code. Flyers are just dressing for the air travel they have, not the air travel they want, said comedian Michelle Wolf. It's a bus in the sky, she said in a December Instagram post. Adam Schlemmer, who was flying through Newark in January, thinks dressing up might discourage hostility among passengers. Personally, he tends to go with sweatpants or jeans and a sweater. Quote, if I was flying business class or flying somewhere where I'm representing somebody or something, I would think to dress more nicely, end of the quote, said the 21-year-old from Charlotte, North Carolina. Lindsay Zern, 32 years old, loves an opportunity to put an outfit together. But when it comes to flying, it's all about comfort. With at least 30 hours of travel in the past year or so, she reaches for an elevated set, that's in quotes, stylish matching athleisure, along with a light jacket for layering and flats. I'm definitely of the belief that when you look good, you feel good, said the QVC sourcing specialist from Westchester, Pennsylvania, but I'm not sure that that mindset alone could make stressful travel moments feel easier, end of her quote. Air travel was once only about dressing up. During the golden age of commercial aviation, flights were the glamorous realm of the wealthy, who could afford the high price of the high life. It was something that only the elite did, said Valerie Steele, director of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. Dressing up was a reflection of that exclusivity and the general luxury that air travel in the 1950s and 1960s entailed, said Steele. Women would wear dresses and stockings, men would don suits and hats. Food was served on fine china, wine and champagne flowed freely. That changed after airlines were largely deregulated in 1978. As flying opened up to the masses and air travel became more routine than adventurous, a downgrade in duds followed, mimicking broader shifts in fashions, but also a downgrade in the experience. To cater to more people, airlines made seating denser and service became, quote-unquote, unbundled, said Shea Oakley, an airline historian. They could charge for everything but the seatbelt in the lavatory, he said. You could fly very cheap, but you'd be flying in a very uncomfortable way. So passengers began dressing accordingly. Jeans and T-shirts became the norm, Oakley said. Still, air travel in the 1980s looks luxurious compared with modern flying. Planes today are more crowded than ever as airlines fight for profitability. Long flight delays are four times more common than they were in 1990, according to federal transportation data analyzed by Maxwell Tabarrok, a PhD student at Harvard. And the multi-layered security checkpoints that have made air travel safer after September 11, 2001, have also made it more miserable. Air rage became more common. The pandemic amplified the behavior, with reports of unruly passengers rising sixfold between 2020 and 2021, according to the FAA. The government has tried other tactics to address the issue. The FAA implemented stiffer penalties in recent years for passengers who act out on planes. Still, some frequent flyers think the Transportation Department's latest campaign might be misguided. Quote, it seems like equating air rage to attire is making clothing the scapegoat for an overly expensive, stressful, and corporate-oriented flying experience, end quote, said Ian Gordon. The 29-year-old project engineer from Richmond, Virginia, usually sticks with sporty sweatpants and a hoodie when he heads to the airport. Oakley, who still throws on a sports jacket and eschews denim when he's flying, thinks Duffy's push is a quote-unquote noble idea that likely won't move the needle as long as flying remains cheap but unpleasant, end quotes. Passengers dress to, quote, withstand the horrors, close quote, that they might expect at the airport, such as a lengthy flight delay that could have them sleeping on the floor, according to Steele. It's such an unpleasant experience to fly now, she said. How dare you blame us? The government shouldn't be surprised, she added, if the flying public shrugs off its campaign. It shouldn't be controversial to suggest dressing respectfully in public, especially in environments where children may be present, a spokesperson for the Transportation Department retorted. The department dubbed the campaign, "The Golden Age of Travel Starts With You," hoping to recall that more fashionable time. For Sarah Nelson, international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, the dress code for maintaining civility on flights boils down to a simpler request. She says, quote, flight attendants would just be happy if people would keep their shoes and socks on, end quote. And that's the end of the article as well. And that is, that's interesting. Okay, the Wall Street Journal has made a column, The A-Head, named for a headline shaped like a capital A, has run on the front page of the Wall Street Journal since 1941. So it's pronounced A-Head, not odd. Although, hey, it could be odd, too. The futile campaign to get people to dress better on planes was the headline for that article. And that was from reporter Dean Seal. We have time for just one more quick article. Tech Slide drags NASDAQ composite to worst day in a month. And it's reported by Heather Gillers. Tech stocks retreated yesterday with declines in NVIDIA and other chip companies, dragging the NASDAQ composite to its worst day in almost a month. Driving the moves, concerns about high valuations and additional regulation. On Tuesday, the Trump administration said NVIDIA must meet new security requirements before sending H200 artificial intelligence chips to China. Meanwhile, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis reiterated plans for consumer protection rules on artificial intelligence. Broadcom and Arm Holdings lost 4.2% and 2.6% respectively. NVIDIA fell 1.4%, and the NASDAQ dropped 1% to notch its worst one-day drop since December 17th. Tech firms' ambitious plans for blowout spending on AI infrastructure had already been making some investors skittish over the past couple of months. I would argue that tech stocks are no longer a safe haven, said Jay Hatfield, CEO at Infrastructure Capital Advisors. They've been a safe haven since the pandemic, but that is not normal. The S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average both fell less than the NASDAQ, losing 0.5% and less than 0.1% respectively. In another example of the so-called rotation trade that has powered recent market moves, investors' growing sense of optimism about the economy and their more cautious view of the AI build-out have spurred a shift away from some of the recent tech high flyers and into stocks poised to benefit from a re-acceleration in growth. Shares of consumer staple companies, healthcare providers, and energy companies edged upward. The equal-weighted S&P 500 gained 0.4%. We don't need the Magnificent Seven to carry the market anymore, said Michael Antonelli, market strategist at Baird, referring to the nickname for the group of Amazon, Alphabet, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, NVIDIA, and Tesla, the top performers that have driven stock gains in recent years. Still, consumer discretionary stocks fell, with the group losing 1.8% to lead declines in the S&P 500, travel stocks taking a particular blow, with Airbnb losing 5.2%, Expedia falling 3.1%, and cruise operators Royal Caribbean, Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings, and Carnival all declined more than 2.5%. Bank shares also took a hit after new earnings reports from major lenders. Wells Fargo fell 4.6% after the lender posted disappointing net income per share, and shares in Bank of America fell too, even after consumer spending led to a 12% rise in quarterly profit. Citi stock also retreated after the bank's quarterly profit was hit by a $1.2 billion loss from the announced sale of its Russia operations. President Trump's proposed 10% cap on credit card interest rates also weighed on banks and credit card firms, said Joseph Brusuelis, chief economist at RSM, and financial shares in the S&P 500 lost 0.2%. Gold and silver futures both hitting new highs boosted by geopolitical tensions. And that was a summary of the market from Heather Gillers. And with that, we come to the close of today's Wall Street Journal program. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Paul Weick, thanking you for tuning in, and stay tuned for more interesting programming here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.